You got her?
Yeah. Yep.
When I went in to just head grab it, I stopped because I realized that my hand wasn't going to fit around its neck. It was going to be like spiking a volleyball. Like, there was no way to get around it. So I actually wound up eventually going one hand on top, one hand underneath, locking in and then shifting into a tighter grip. I dragged it out to the edge of the levee, and then Ryan pulled it out. He did a lot of the fighting, and then whenever he needed my assistance, I would help him unravel the coils off of him. But these pythons are actually so big, it's the only way to effectively control them. Dealing with one that size was a situation that there is no way to prepare for that, I promise you.
Hi, I'm Jan Renner, founder of Roaring Earth.
And I'm science reporter Kate Morgan.
In each episode of the Roaring Earth podcast, our contributing reporters explore mysteries of the animal world, delving into the science behind amazing wildlife interactions captured on video by people like you.
You just heard Kevin Pavlidis reliving the biggest moment of his life. In October of 2020, he and his hunting buddy, Ryan Osborne, captured a record-setting 18-foot, 9-inch-long Burmese python in the Florida Everglades. That is a snake the size of a 2-story building.
Video footage of the hunters wrestling a monster snake out of the swamp captivated millions on the Roaring Earth platforms. There were so many questions and comments. We asked Kate to find out more. How exactly to become a python hunter? What's it like to catch a predator that huge? And what are Burmese pythons doing in Florida?
No one can agree on exactly how the first pythons got to Florida. Maybe they were exotic pets released by irresponsible owners. Maybe they escaped accidentally from a building destroyed in a hurricane. Maybe it was both. There are a lot of theories. But sometime in the late 1970s, a small population of Burmese pythons was established in the Florida Everglades and started slithering toward total domination.
There were a few scattered sightings throughout the 80s and 90s, and it really started to pick up in the early 2000s.
That's Mike Rochford, a wildlife biologist who spent more than a decade in South Florida studying invasive species like the Burmese python. At first, he says, no one wanted to believe the snake invasion was real. Pythons were an incredibly popular pet. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service reports that just under 100,000 of them were imported to the United States in the decade between 1996 and 2006. And scientists struggled to convince the public that this snake situation was getting very, very bad.
It's really hard to prove to people and get the idea across to people that, you know, this is happening. The burden of proof was immense, and nobody really wanted to accept it without a great deal of evidence. So finding the first python nest was a big deal.
Let's back up for a second and talk about the creature in question, just in case you're not totally up on your snake knowledge. The Burmese python is one of the largest snakes in the world, averaging between 8 and 14 feet long and weighing 200 pounds or more. And even in the wild, they often live more than 20 years. They're excellent climbers, using their tail to wrap themselves around trees, and excellent swimmers, able to stay underwater for half an hour at a time. They eat mostly small mammals and birds, stalking them using chemical receptors and heat sensors in their tongue. They hunt by biting and holding their prey with sharp rear-facing teeth. Then the python wraps its body around the animal and constricts its powerful muscles, cutting off air and blood flow for a quick, efficient kill. Then they stretch open their flexible jaw and swallow it whole. A python can get its mouth around an animal 5 times bigger than the snake's head. The name Burmese python is a little misleading. They are native to Myanmar, formerly known as Burma, but that's not their only home. The python can be found across southern and southeast Asia, from India to Indonesia and north into China. Ironically, in most of their wild range, the Burmese python is considered either threatened or vulnerable, thanks to habitat degradation, capture for the pet trade, and slaughter for the global snakeskin leather market. In the United States, however, their numbers are steadily growing, but that is not a good thing. That first clutch of snake eggs in Florida was proof of what Rochford and other biologists feared. Pythons were breeding in the Everglades. Maybe that doesn't seem like a big deal. After all, the tropical wetland ecosystem of South Florida supports more than 24 native snake species. But Burmese pythons, where they don't belong, are a jumbo-sized problem. The one Kevin Pavlidis caught was just 1 inch shy of the biggest python ever measured, which means these monsters have made themselves very happily at home in Florida, thriving in the 1.5 million acres of Everglades National Park.
They're adapted very well to the Everglades, and they're generalists, so they can survive in a variety of different habitats. They can be pretty aquatic. They're very comfortable in the water. They can swim long distances. And they can also do fine in drier environments. So they really don't have any trouble adapting to South Florida.
And clearly they don't have any trouble multiplying. In one nest, a female python can lay between 20 and 75 eggs. Hatchlings grow fast. They can be 6 feet long before they're 6 months old. And all those growing snakes need lots and lots of food. In the 5 or so years it takes a Burmese python to get 13 feet long, it will have eaten roughly 1 raccoon, 1 opossum, 5 mud hens, 6 little blue herons, 8 ibises, 10 squirrels, 15 rabbits, 15 wrens, 30 cotton rats, 72 mice, 4 alligators, and maybe a deer. For good measure.
The impact has been dramatic, especially in the park where we've done studies, and we've seen declines of, 90-95% of some mammal species. Basically any bird or mammal or alligator that they can get a hold of and physically swallow, they will. So they're very opportunist, and if they get the opportunity, they'll eat anything that they see.
And in return, almost nothing is eating them. When they're small, which is only for a couple of months, they might get nabbed by a bird of prey or a gator. But they very quickly rise to the top of the food chain, eating a bit of everything else along the way. In short, the introduction of this one animal has thrown the entire ecosystem into absolute chaos. So, how do you get rid of an animal with no natural enemies? You put a bounty on its head.
It's $50 for the first 4 feet and $25 each foot after that. So a 10-foot snake would be about $200 or so.
Donna Khalil is the leader of the Everglades Avengers. That's really their name. A team of professional snake hunters. There are roughly 100 of these hunters, contracted by the South Florida Water Management District and Florida Fish and Wildlife Commission. And they spend their evenings bagging as many of the scaly invaders as they can. Over the past several years, they've removed more than 5,000.
I am a python elimination specialist, and that's exactly what it sounds like. I eliminate pythons, as many as I can, from the Everglades, because they don't belong there. They are invasive species, and we're trying our best to manage them, trying to get them under control.
But sometimes the lines between hunter and hunted become blurred. Pythons are at the top of the food chain in the Everglades, and even an elimination specialist like Donna can end up on the menu. More on that when we come back.
Before the break, we learned that Burmese pythons are wreaking havoc on the Everglades, growing at record speeds, reproducing like crazy, and eating pretty much everything in sight. As invasive species situations go, it's a worst-case scenario. The only thing conservationists can do is try to remove as many snakes as possible. And that's where python elimination specialists come in. Back to Kate's report.
For Donna Khalil, python hunting is basically a full-time job, and it goes something like this. She and her teammates, sometimes fellow pro hunters, sometimes volunteers who come from all over the world, meet up at sunset and jump into Donna's truck, which has a big platform on top rigged with ultra-bright spotlights. They head into the Everglades, driving one of the few navigable paths into the wetlands, on top of a levee. They creep along until they catch a python in their light.
As soon as we come up on one, I like to go slow and quiet because they can hear you, but they're generally very intent on what they're doing. And if you don't startle them, you can literally walk right up alongside of them and watch them continue to hunt. And I've done that on several occasions. And just get right up to the head within a couple of inches, and then I grab them by the head and by the tail, and then the wrestling is on. Once you grab them, they're gonna fight back. They don't wanna be held. They're not pets anymore. They haven't been for decades. These are all wild snakes, and once you grab them, they wanna get away. It'll try to wrap itself around your hands and then pull its head out of your grip. And that's something you don't want to have happen. If you don't do it right, they can wrap around your arm or your neck, and that's never good. So you don't want them to do that. You want to keep them low and to the ground and away from you, and certainly don't want to let them get around your neck.
Donna knows what she's talking about and knows exactly how it feels when a Burmese python, a snake that coils itself around its prey and squeezes tighter and tighter, cutting off blood flow until the heart stops beating, decides to go for the kill.
I had caught over 100. I was very confident in what I was doing. And I let my guard down. And basically, I grabbed the python. It was a 7-footer. And my daughter called me. So I answered my phone with one hand. And I had my snake, the python, in the other hand. And I was just telling her, Deanne, I just caught a snake. You know, I just caught a python. I'll have to call you back. And in those few seconds to say that, the snake wrapped up around my arm, came up around my neck, and started choking me out. And literally what it did was it wrapped around my neck and put pressure on my carotid arteries. And that pressure will make you black out, you know? And that's exactly what it was doing. It knows exactly how to take out its enemy.
Lucky for Donna, she wasn't hunting alone. She stumbled out of the water and managed to get the attention of one of her partners just in time for them to pull off the python. Snake elimination isn't easy work, physically or mentally. At the end of each night, Donna has to dispatch each of the snakes she's caught.
I use a 22 short with hollow points, and it's one shot to the brain, and that's the end of it. That's the thing. I mean, this is something that, you know, it sounds odd, but I don't want to hurt the snake, but I know I have to kill it, you know? So I catch it and show it complete respect as I'm catching and doing everything I need to do with it. But at the end of the day, there's not enough zoos that can take them. You know, it's basically illegal to keep them down here anymore because of the damage that they've done. So, you know, that's what has to happen. They have to be euthanized.
It's been proposed that pythons caught in the Everglades could be repatriated to their native lands, sent back to the countries where python populations are struggling. But that could have even worse ramifications. Scientists can't be sure what pathogens and parasites these snakes are carrying, which they could potentially transmit to wild Asian snakes. Ultimately, each python euthanized in Florida protects a dozen or more species of native animals that snake would have eaten. Not to mention the domestic animals that belong to local people.
Basically, now the pythons are being found in people's yards. They're after cats. I went on a call a couple of weeks back that right in the middle of the suburb, there was a 7.5-foot python that was going after their cat. So yeah, they're coming into our areas now.
The presence of the pythons also makes it much harder for the native snakes of the Everglades. Eastern indigo and eastern garter, Florida brown and rat snakes, even venomous natives like the cottonmouth, coral, and diamondback rattlesnake, which suddenly have to compete with young pythons and even hatchlings for dwindling numbers of small prey.
And if you think of all of those little pythons with really hungry tummies, they're going to go out there and they're going to eat everything that our native snakes, which are about the same size, rely on to survive. So they can decimate the food source for our native snakes.
Donna and her fellow hunters don't capture and kill pythons because they hate them. In fact, it's the opposite. She has devoted her life to reptilian well-being.
Everyone that I know pretty much loves snakes, but loves the environment more so. And that's me. I love snakes. I love lizards. I love rabbits. I love every animal out there. All the natives belong. It's just this one invasive snake that doesn't.
Kevin Pavlidis, nickname Snakeaholic, who shot the video that inspired this episode, feels exactly the same way. He is not in it for the killing. Actually, he's a vegan. But a lifelong love for snakes makes him one of, if not the most, successful python hunters in the game.
But I've been working with large, dangerous reptiles for virtually my entire life. If there's a dangerous animal that can kill you, I probably want to play with it. I've been very, very passionate about reptiles since I was a little kid, and I've always wanted to work and with them. And the older I got, the bigger and more dangerous the animals got. You know, this is not about snakes. This is about invasive species. And who are the best people to remove invasive snakes? People that have spent their whole lives playing with snakes, because we love them.
That's not the only reptile Kevin feels strongly about. He may be a python hunter by night, but during the day he works as, get this, a professional alligator wrestler. At each performance, he teaches his audience all about the American alligator, the quintessential species of the Everglades, which at their largest can reach 14 feet long and more than 1,000 pounds. But even they are threatened by the presence of the python. It's not just that the snakes are eating all the prey that would otherwise feed the gators. A medium-sized python can easily swallow a young alligator, and even alligators around 5 feet long. For context, that is as big as I am, are regularly attacked and eaten by 10-foot-long plus pythons.
I mean, these are incredibly powerful apex predators. They're not just eating mice and rats like you would think. I have personally seen a 5-foot alligator inside the stomach of a 14-foot python. I've found deer hooves inside of a python. They're big animals. And once they get into that 17-18-foot class, they can take down 7-foot alligators, full-grown hogs, full-grown deer. They could take down some serious prey items. So it's not just the little things that scales up, the food pyramid. They're eating all along it.
Kevin's an incredibly devoted python eliminator. He's out in the glades roughly 5 nights a week and almost never goes home empty-handed. Still, it won't be enough to eliminate a species that is flourishing the way the python is.
The reason why we have tons of invasive species in South Florida, almost everything survives here. I'm sure there's been Burmese pythons released in every single state in the United States. The problem is they typically don't survive. But here, the climate is perfect.
Here's the thing. Now that pythons have gotten themselves established in Florida, they're not going anywhere. The removal program isn't a total solution. Even at their very best, Florida's python hunters may only be making a tiny dent in the overall snake population, enough to take some of the pressure off raccoons and marsh rabbits, but that's really it. There are just too many snakes.
Now, I'll give you a scientific breakdown, and you're not going to like it. So there was a study done in a captive environment in North Carolina. They built an enclosure. They released a bunch of Burmese pythons in there, sent trained people in to search for these animals, you know, routinely over and over again under various conditions. Through that study, they barely found any of them. In fact, they found that the species detection rate for Burmese pythons was 0.5% to 1% of the population.
So let's do some snake math. Initial estimates placed the invasive Everglades population between 1 and 300,000. In the last few years, python hunters have captured and killed more than 5,000. If that's 1%, we're actually looking at a population of 500,000.
With a less conservative estimate, but still extremely realistic, 1 million snakes. So, yeah. You do the math and you tell me if you think there's 100,000 to 300,000 of them.
Based on that logic, no, I really don't. And neither does wildlife biologist Mike Rochford, who agrees that initial estimate could be way low.
Yeah, it's really hard to say. I mean, the Everglades are, you know, over 1 million acres, and pythons can inhabit most of that, if not all of it. I would not be shocked if there's 1 million pythons out there.
Now I'm gonna really blow your mind, and not in a good way. 1 million huge, hungry, invasive Burmese pythons may be the least of Florida's problems.
Before the break, Kate spoke to a scientist who specializes in understanding snakes and two hunters who specialize in eliminating them to illustrate the staggering scale of Florida's python problem. But as bad as they are, the snakes might not be the biggest threat to the Everglades.
Python hunting in the Everglades gets a lot of attention. Kevin Pavlidis' Roaring Earth video alone got more than 1 million views, shares, likes, and comments. And I mean, it's a sensational thing. People wrestling 18-foot-long snakes in the name of conservation is certainly enough to catch your attention. But the Everglades have other, potentially even more sinister problems. South Florida has more non-native species of reptiles and amphibians than anywhere else in the world. There are dozens of other documented invaders, ranging from tiny frogs to Nile crocodiles. The scale of the issue is so large, and it's just plain impossible to undo.
I don't think South Florida will ever get back to being like normal. I mean, we have an invasive species in every single category. You pick a type of animal, we have an invasive species in there. You know, snakes, we got pythons, we got blind snakes, lizards, we have several different species of iguanas, tegus, monitors, crocodilians, we have spectacled caiman out here, and we've had individual findings of other, you know, crocodilian species, Niles and black caiman and stuff like that. We've had, you know, the amount of invasive fish is ridiculous. We have parrots, we have monkeys, it's everything.
In a decade of work in the Everglades, Mike Rochford has seen dozens of non-native species show up. The python isn't the only large reptile making a significant impact on the structure of Florida's food web.
We've got Argentine black and white tegus, which are just a little bit smaller, and those are both voracious predators of pretty much anything smaller than them. They're really good nest predators, so they'll dig up turtle nests or alligator nests. They'd eat bird nests.
The tegus are really trouble. Natives of the rainforests, savannas, and deserts of Central South America, the Argentine black and white is the largest of the tegus, growing to be about 3 feet long. Imagine a scaly, pit bull-sized lizard covered in spots and stripes, walking around eating everything in sight. They're indiscriminate omnivores and arguably as popular in the pet trade as pythons. Irresponsible owners have let them escape or set them free, and they've established breeding populations that have biologists and conservationists very, very worried. And soon, the python and tegu issue might not just be Florida's problem. Some have suggested Burmese pythons could spread as far north as Washington, D.C. Mike thinks they probably won't go that far, so don't expect to see Burmese pythons in the Rose Garden or swimming through the reflecting pool. But that doesn't mean they'll stay confined to Florida. And the tegu is an altogether different story. Though they're native to more tropical climates, they're some of the hardiest reptiles and could survive and thrive across a wide geographic range. They've already been spotted in Georgia, South Carolina, Alabama, Louisiana, and Texas.
I always wonder, you know, what does the future hold? I remember when the first pythons were discovered on Key Largo, and that just blew my mind at the time. You know, we haven't seen the end of this. Even with the species that have been here a while, like pythons, you know, we don't know that their range expansion is over. They might go a little farther north still. I think Argentine black and white tegus really might invade the entire southeastern U.S., and that's really, I think, the future of the invasive reptile problem.
And in Florida, at the epicenter of it all, the invasives and the alligators may be cruising for a "this town ain't big enough for the both of us" scenario. Alligators have ruled the Everglades for 200 million years, but soon they might be outpaced by predators that are eating the eggs from their nests, in the case of tegus, or, like the pythons, eating the gators' prey and their young.
You know, I think we're seeing these pretty big losses. You know, even these huge predators like alligators, it's not uncommon at all to see that the pythons are trying to take out an alligator, or that the tegus are trying to eat all their eggs. Just seen a lot of things disappear that should have stayed there, and a lot of things show up that never should have arrived in the first place. You don't want to think about all these things disappearing, but at some point you've got to hit some critical point. You know, the Everglades, you know, might not ever look the same. That's a very real possibility.
But that's not a reason to give up. The preservation of an ecosystem as unique and special as the Everglades is a war worth fighting, even if all we're managing to do at the moment is arm the next generation of conservationists for battle.
You know, it's a problem that we started, and it's a problem that we need to fix. And, you know, one thing to think about is right now we don't have the technology to solve these problems, but maybe in 50 years we might. And so if we can keep it controlled as much as possible right now, you know, maybe there is hope for the future.
That's the kind of optimism that keeps people like Donna Khalil and Kevin Pavlidis going out night after night to catch snakes.
Like I said, I don't think we'll ever get them all, but every single one counts. Each one that we remove, we're making a positive difference.
We're fighting towards wildlife conservation. That's all what it comes down to. We're fighting really hard to try and give our native animals another chance and help balance that ecosystem out a little bit.
The best thing anyone can do if they care about the Everglades and want to preserve that wild, otherworldly ecosystem and its animals is get the ones that don't belong out of there. Sure, not everybody wants to wrestle a snake the size of a full-grown giraffe. But if you do, Donna and the Everglades Avengers are always looking for volunteers.
Thanks, Kate. That's an unbelievable story. But how crazy that an entire ecosystem could be put in jeopardy by a few escaped pets.
Yeah, if you take nothing else away from this, please keep any and all pets inside their approved habitat at all times.
Thanks for listening to the Roaring Earth podcast. If you liked our show, please follow us on your favorite podcast app and share with your friends. Comments and reviews are always greatly appreciated. For more info on today's episode, including videos and research, visit roaringearth.com. On our next episode, we explore the awesome power of fires and their vital role in our world. It's based on stunning footage shared with us of one of nature's most ferocious phenomenon, firenadoes. Fires so powerful and intense, they literally turn into tornadoes. Until then, send us your amazing wildlife and nature videos so we can delve deep into the story behind them. The Roaring Earth podcast was written and produced by Kate Morgan. Sound engineering and original music was provided by Joe Baseri. Jan Renner and Glenn Hoffman are the executive producers. Special thanks to Mike Rochford, Donna Khalil, and Kevin Pavlidis. I'm Jan Renner for Roaring Earth.